So our next speaker is Dr. Tony Runkle. And Tony is known to all of us as Chief Hydrologist in the Minnesota Geological Survey.
Chief Hydrologist?
That's what I got.
I didn't put that.
We have given him the honorific. And he's also an adjunct professor in the Department of Earth Sciences. Both are part of the School of Earth Sciences at the University of Minnesota. He specializes in the geology of southeastern Minnesota, including the Twin Cities area. And for the past 15 years, he has been obsessed with, mostly with the holes in the rock that play a critical role in the hydrogeologic system. He holds a PhD in geology from the University of Texas in Austin, a master's from the University of Montana, and a bachelor's from the University of Minnesota. We're glad he's back in Minnesota. Tony has obliged me today to be our switch hitter. He's gonna give two mini talks in the next half hour, next 40 minutes. And the first is about vertical fractures in line with our morning's theme. And he'll be talking about vertical fractures and what we're learning from outcrops and the implications for aquitards. And then he'll proceed and transition us to a couple of our karst talks that are going to follow and talk about the structural control in Fillmore County's karstic spring sheds. Tony.
Thank you, Kelton. And thank you for scheduling me directly after Beth and Jesse.
I feel about
this tall standing up here right now. Beth and Jesse are talking about a toolbox with 150 different tools working at sites all over the world, 16 multi-ported wells in the Madison area, all this in an effort to characterize fractures. And what I'm going to talk about, at least in the first part of the talk here, is essentially me and Bob and Julia walking up to outcrops and going, "Wow, look at those fractures, man. Aren't they cool?" And I'm not exaggerating. All right. But let's move on with it and see how much of it you believe. As Kelton indicated, I'm gonna in 30 minutes give a two-part talk. So each part will be fairly brief. And really, these are sort of progress reports more than anything else. We don't have any firm conclusions with either of these studies, but we've seen some things in both studies that indicate this work warrants further investigation. And if people after hearing this talk want to email us or try to catch us out in the hall, we'd like to hear any ideas you all might have about the work we're doing and whether it you think it might prove fruitful to better understand groundwater flow. So what I'll be doing here is starting in, say, part A of the talk, as Kelton mentioned, is describing what we're trying to do with vertical fracture patterns, specifically trying to determine what we can learn just simply from observing outcrops and trying to link the outcrop observations to subsurface hydrogeologic information and see where we're going with that. The second part that I'll finish with, an example is up here, and it'll be higher in the Paleozoic stratigraphic column, will be an effort, or a more recent effort, and definitely more in progress, collaborating with Calvin Alexander and Jeff Green, where they've been doing dye traces in the most extreme southern part of the state, where the Paleozoic bedrock is heavily karsted. They've done dye traces for, I believe, well over 20 years, certainly at least as far back as the mid-1990s. And what we're trying to figure out in this second research project is whether the structural controls, there may be structural controls that exert some influence on groundwater flow directions in what are typically viewed as pretty unpredictable settings for groundwater flow. All right, so we're going to start with the work we did on the Platteville with tracing vertical fractures. I'm going to start with an introduction slide of some work that was done out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And as I've commented in many other talks in the past, it still bothers me, but I have to continue to give due credit, that many times I start a talk by saying, here's what they did over in Madison, and now we're copying it over here. But it has worked out that way many times. In this particular case, it was a study done by a master student named Chad Underwood, who's now actually mostly a bridge engineer here in the Twin Cities metro area, along with a woman named faculty member named Michelle Cook. And what they were looking at is some Silurian rocks in quarries, and basically taking photographs of those quarries and tracing the fracture patterns, as simple as that. And what they were interested in, and this is called mechanical stratigraphy, is they were interested in trying to see if they could define stratigraphic units that differ from one another based on fracture characteristics. And of course, this could be quite important hydrogeologically. And one example, they were kind of focused on fracture terminations more than fracture density and fracture spacing. And so, for instance, you see this interval right down here, shaded gray near the lower part of their sketch. It shows where vertical fractures have preferentially terminate above and below it. That is, very few, and in this case, no vertical fractures continuously cross that bed. Therefore, that bed is a mechanical unit that inhibits the propagation of vertical fractures. Well, think about it hydrogeologically. There could be a couple implications, one of which is of great interest to us, and one reason we looked at the Platteville, is that that could be, therefore, a key aquitard bed, okay? A key inhibitor to vertical flow. So, as I said, we decided to go ahead and try to do this with the Platteville in the Twin Cities metro area. There's a couple of reasons we picked the Platteville. One is it's close to home. We didn't have much funding to do this work, a little bit from the Metropolitan Council, but mostly on just university discretionary money. So it's close to home. We didn't have to travel far. The Platteville is widely exposed in the Twin Cities metro area. In addition, there is a lot of hydrogeologic information associated with it, mostly from contamination sites, Superfund sites, that kind of thing. And in addition, there's quite a bit of information on rock mechanical properties, and I'll get to that in just a minute. A brief overview of the Platteville. It's divided into four members. In the lowermost part, you have the pecatonical member, just a foot and a half thick. A Mifflin member, much thicker, 10 to 13 feet thick. It's a carbonate mudstone with thin shale seams, shale or silty seams, thinly bedded texture. Hidden Falls member is about a meter and a half thick, and it's an argillaceous carbonate rock that's typically internally structureless. And then you have the Magnolia member on top, which is thin to medium bedded, and the beds are usually defined by coquina layers. There isn't a whole lot of shale at all in the Magnolia member, all right? Outcrop representative of those three members. And then, as I said, we do have a number of engineering type tests of rock properties, tensile strength tests and compressive strength tests. There's at least dozens. We haven't compiled them all yet. They're in reports by Charles Nelson and Associates, but there are at least dozens, perhaps hundreds of these tests on core samples. And what you typically find is the Magnolia has a compressive strength PSI of 15 to 20 K, as does the Mifflin and the Pecatonica, with the Hidden Falls being markedly different, about 40% to half the strength of the units above and below it. And as you'll see here soon, that's going to probably play a role in what we see with the fracture patterns. All right, I wasn't lying. We go to outcrops and we stare at them and we say, yeah, this looks like a good one where we can take a high resolution photograph and have Julia Steinberg from MGS, who played the most important role in this part of the investigation, take the photograph back to work, put it on a computer screen, and start following the fractures with these traces like this. This particular outcrop is useful because it is a very relatively accessible Platteville outcrop. Therefore, the fractures could be traced, and then the trace photograph brought back to the field and compared to reality, because sometimes the shadows and things like that make it difficult to trace these fractures on an outcrop. At this time, until I get to the next slide, I'm not going to say much more about this particular one, except just to give you another couple seconds just to stare here in particular, where you don't have kind of the outcrop behind the lines, to see what you all see in this fracture pattern. Any trends or anything like that? All right? Now we've moved to a much more beautiful outcrop, unfortunately inaccessible, but we did manage to get very high resolution photographs of this outcrop and mesh them together, did the same kind of fracture tracing, and the Hidden Falls, basically the scale's a little different here, comes right across here, an outcrop right across here, just to kind of reference yourself to the last photograph. Again, take a look at those fracture patterns, and I'll run through this list of what we see. We've done more than two outcrops. These are definitely the best. That's why I put them in the talk. Our conclusion in doing our fracture tracing is that each member of the Platteville has a different style of fracture density and spacing. Therefore, they are mechanical units. The contacts between the members typically terminate vertical fractures, therefore they are mechanical interfaces or mechanical beds that terminate vertical fractures, and that the vertical fractures preferentially terminate at the top and the bottom of the Hidden Falls member. Last, individual fractures extending through the entire formation are only rarely present, and where we do see them, it's typically on the very edge, eroded edges of the outcrops. When you try to squeeze a 45-minute talk into 30 minutes, what you do is you take five different slides and you put them all onto one, and then try to run through them really, really quickly. This is a summary of our hydrologic information that we think in different ways kind of matches up or is consistent with what we're viewing in the outcrop patterns. I'll start up here in the upper left. Right up here, again, Charles Nelson and Associates, for the most part, have a wealth of data from a number of engineering sites and underground building projects where they've done Packer tests on the Platteville Formation. Though this is one example of dozens of Packer tests, and it's a representative example in that you typically get on the order of about 8 orders of magnitude range in hydraulic connectivity, with typically the lower Hidden Falls and the Mifflin being down to, say, 0.1 or less feet per day, with many of the tests being kind of off scale. That is less than 10, the resolution they could measure, which is less than 10 to the minus 4 feet per day. Above that, with the Magnolia, you typically get connectivities of a few feet per day to as much as about 100 feet per day. And then in particular, what I want to really particularly point out is that there's about a half meter interval in here that commonly has bedding parallel conduits in which the tests show a much greater hydraulic connectivity. We have done borehole injection flow meter logging in a number of wells. I think we're up to 8 now, and we get, for a hydraulic connectivity of this discrete interval here, we get numbers ranging from a few hundred feet per day to as much as 40,000 feet per day. Okay, again, contrast kind of that Packer test with this fracture pattern, at least just for now, and I'll be talking more about this later. How about just more outcrop observations? The Platteville is a common source of springs in the Twin Cities metro area. Julia is our, not only did all the fracture tracing work, she is our resident Platteville stratigraphy expert. She went to every map spring and linked springs to the stratigraphic position from which they emerge from the Platteville. These are perched, it's important to point out, these are perched springs, by the way. And the St. Peter is dry as well. This is a perched, kind of a doubly perched aquifer system we're talking about here. And what's interesting, at least to us, is that you can see of the 48 springs that were mapped and gauged relative to stratigraphic position, the highest total is right at the top of the Hidden Falls, basically where we're seeing these fracture terminations, these vertical fracture terminations. A slightly smaller number, but combining the two, well, slightly smaller number, 12 springs, is at the bottom of the Hidden Falls, which we think, but now we're not quite sure, might be a near edge step down effect. That is, our hypothesis is that most water is flowing across these bedding plane fractures, perched across this interval where vertical fractures don't breach, and then water either emerges at the top of the Hidden Falls or steps down in near surface outcrops to the bottom of the Hidden Falls. Last, I'd like to skip this diagram. Actually, maybe that was subconscious. Last, in the past year or so, you may have seen some of these data in earlier talks as far back as a year and a half ago. These are data we've collected just in the last 1 year. What we've done now is we've got kind of a poor person's homemade Packer device that Bob Tipping has put together, and we've gone in a number of the holes that we've already flow meter logged and injection flow meter logged, and with this single Packer system, we can measure heads above the Packer and head below the Packer as we progress down the hole. We have some concerns and uncertainties about some of these data, so I'm going to cut to the chase with what we think we're confident in, and what we think we're confident in is that when we bring the Packer, considering only measurements below the Packer, head measurements below the Packer, which are in gray here, what we have consistently seen in all the holes is a big deflection or jump in head, or using Jesse's terminology, an inflection, I think is what Jesse used, an inflection in head that corresponds to the top of the Hidden Falls, again corresponding to the point at which we see the termination of these vertical fractures in outcrop. Just a couple more slides on the Platteville here. I want to mention a potential link to bedding plane conduits. One of the things that Chad Underwood and Michelle Cook mentioned is it's useful to do this kind of mechanical stratigraphy and look for fracture terminations, because perhaps in a system that does have water available to it, water directed vertically downward in these fractures, if it reached a termination point, a mechanical interface, perhaps that would redirect that water horizontally and lead to enhanced dissolution at a mechanical interface. So here we're not really so much talking about an aquitard being present because of the termination of these vertical fractures, but also maybe the highest K intervals being developed at the same termination interval. And do we see that with the Platteville? Well, yeah, I already described these springs. Again, here's where our fractures terminate. This is Underwood's just kind of conceptual or general schematic model. This is a typical spring with a fracture at the top of the Hidden Falls, and this is just to remind you of those Packer tests and flow meter tests that indicate high K right here. So that's why we put an aquitard here, or a key aquitard that inhibits vertical fracturing, but right immediately above it, we do have this high, very high K interval. It'd be great if we never collected any more data beyond this. It'd be a lot easier to describe what we think is the system. Now that not regrettably, but the most recent hole we got in last fall actually turned out to be more complex in some ways than this simple system. And that is, in one discrete interval, the top of the Hidden Falls would be roughly right here. One discrete interval, again, in this Hidden Falls Magnolia contact strata interval, we found two high K bedding parallel conduits that had about a 3 meter difference in head. So again, in our view, you have to add another mechanical unit that inhibits the propagation of vertical fractures to account for or hold up or hold that difference between head there. And so you look at this, and again, a little more complex here, and this is where we start scratching our heads a little bit, particularly with regard to classification. What do you call this? Because in 1 meter of strata, we have the highest K known in the Platteville, but we also have the largest vertical head and jump, and probably, we think, the lowest vertical K. And that's one example, a small-scale example, of where we're invoking the name aquitardifer for lack of a better term we can think of. What I want to finish with here is try to link, if I can make it, link very quickly to Jesse's preceding talk and the talk that's going to follow me by Jeff Green. With Jesse's talk, you should all understand what this is showing. In fact, this is one of her inflections right here. What I zoomed in, Jesse has data going all the way down to the Mount Simon. I zoomed in specifically on the St. Lawrence and Franconia formations and the contact across them, where you do see this deflection or inflection in the head profile. As part of a separate project called the St. Lawrence Aquitard Project, funded by the LCCMR, I've been going out and trying to find St. Lawrence, Franconia, and new name Tunnel City. I've been around too long with Franconia in my brain. Contact strata. And what we're finding, although the outcrops aren't nearly as amenable to vertical fracture tracing as, say, a nice carbonate unit like the Platteville, we do seem to see prominent vertical joints in the St. Lawrence formation that terminate somewhere within the upper couple meters of the Tunnel City group. So I would suggest that at least one possibility for some of the deflections in head or inflections that Jesse has seen is that at the Wisconsin site could be accounted for by this kind of physical relationship, having a mechanical unit or interface at which vertical fractures preferentially terminate. Secondly, I'm not going to talk a lot about Jeff's work, but this probably, at least these general kind of conditions, do apply to what Jeff's going to discuss with his dye tracing through the St. Lawrence aquitardifer. That is, Jeff inserts dye stratigraphically high in the St. Lawrence, it travels down in the St. Lawrence, and a key point here is that the emergence of the dye, or really the spring clusters we commonly see in these settings, appear to be preferentially located right at the bottom of the St. Lawrence. Again, maybe indicating that it has something to do with the mechanical stratigraphy at the contact between these two units. To summarize, with our vertical fracture tracing work, the results thus far, yes, I think fracture patterns in outcrop can help us predict certain hydraulic characteristics in the subsurface. And what are we going to do in the future? One thing we want to do is look for this in other units. I gave you the example of the St. Lawrence Franconia. We think we see similar relationships, that is preferential termination at certain horizons in the lower part of the Oneota. We also think we see it in the lower part of the Galena group, if that's where I am right there. I think I'm in the lower part of the Galena group there. So we want to start documenting these fracture terminations at a number of different stratigraphic horizons across southeastern Minnesota. It would be great to get discrete interval head profiles like the ones Jesse gets to get similar wells installed in Minnesota. That'd be a nice compatible piece of information. We're trying to do that at least at one site in Minnesota right now. With the Platteville Formation, we're further along, but we would like to go back into these holes with a double packer system and perhaps longer term in some of these holes where the units are somewhat, where the lower part of the Platteville is of somewhat low permeability, and we're not sure we're getting equilibration on some of the heads we're measuring there. And we'd like to add to the mechanical rock tests and hopefully maybe include ductility as well, ductility tests. Okay, for the second part of this test, as I mentioned, we wanted to test the potential for structural controls on ditrace flow patterns in extreme southeastern Minnesota, Fillmore County, actually. As I mentioned, Kelvin Alexander and Jeff Green, and I'm sure quite a few other people in collaboration with Kelvin and Jeff, have been running ditraces down in Fillmore County for a number of years, for several decades now. And they've come up with some really interesting patterns in terms of flow directions. And there are enough traces in some places that they've actually delineated spring shed boundaries. So what you're looking on in this map is that the violet lines represent the trace flow paths for individual ditraces, and the orange dashed lines represent spring shed boundaries. Okay? And as you might expect, if you know anything about karst hydrogeology, many of these spring shed boundaries don't correspond to watershed, surface watershed boundaries. And many of these flow paths are quite unpredictable. For instance, just a kind of a minor example, dye was entered here in a sinkhole, put into a sinkhole here. There are a number of springs very close to that sinkhole here. I'm not sure this one quite shows on the map. I might have covered it with the strat column. Here and here, where the dye didn't exit, and instead it took a much longer path to get to this sinkhole here. To kind of orient yourself stratigraphically, for almost all of these dye traces, the dye is entered either through sinks or losing streams relatively high in the stratigraphic section, meaning in the lower Spillville, the Maquoketa, the Dubuque, or the upper part of the Galena group. And most of the dye exits, and that would be most of the springs you see around here, not all but most, are coming out low in the Cummingsville member. So basically the preferential position of springs and then most dye exits then is coming out above what we think is a fairly major aquitard in the system right here. In terms of the geologic setting, before I move on to the next slide and start to build a structure map, what we're dealing with here is rocks that are just very gently, less than a half a degree, dipping to the southwest here. You're also going up in elevation from northeast to southwest, and for that reason, you're basically climbing in the stratigraphic section as you head from this area and work your way up. To link to the map, because I'm going to be showing this map several times, the Decorah, Platteville, Glenwood, which is right in this part of the section, is the green you see around here, and then the Cedar Valley group, the highest part of the section mapped, is over here, right? So you can get a sense of that. All right, I'm just going to very quickly run through a series of slides here that lead up to how the structural map was created, and then I'm going to superimpose the dye traces on top of that. This just gives you a sense of the control we had to make the structure map. What we rely on are outcrops, which are the small red blebs you see on the map. Water well records are critically important, and we think we have pretty good coverage with that. Those are the yellow dots. And then natural gamma logs. The natural gamma logs are critical to kind of give us some kind of control, measure of control on the water well records to make sure that the drillers have seemed to be accurately describing what's in those wells. So we've got reasonably good coverage, especially compared to many other parts of southeastern Minnesota. And also importantly, we're working a part of the stratigraphic section that has a number of easily distinguished contacts. For instance, the top of the St. Peter, the transition between the Glenwood Shale and the St. Peter, is a contact that virtually every water well driller is going to pick up on. And that facilitates the ease at which we can interpret these water well records. And so here's our structure map. What it shows, basically, these contours, they're 25-foot contours, and they represent the elevation of the top of the St. Peter sandstone. But importantly, if you just so everyone understands here, everything above the tectonic forces that caused this this folding, and in some places faulting, affected the entire rock package. So the structure you see in the St. Peter is propagated up into all the units through which we die traced. All right, so just keep that in mind. Point out just a few key features or examples of the things you want to look for. Prominent syncline here. As I mentioned earlier, the rocks regionally all dip about less than a half a degree in that direction, but superimposed on that, prominent syncline here, anticline here, anticline here, that kind of thing. And this includes the die traces. What I've done with the die traces here, they are all one color on the earlier slide, is I've color-coded them three ways. What you want to do is you want to look for blue lines representing the die traces. For instance, in this area, those are die traces in which the water traveled structurally down dip. You look for the red ones, those are die traces that indicate water traveled structurally up dip. And there's a few yellow ones we're not going to worry about. They are either, they're ones where we're uncertain the direction of flow relative to structural dip for one reason or another. And you can see a few patterns here. And I'm going to show a couple of specific examples when I finish up here. For instance, a pattern I see is that in this general area, the spring sheds have flow paths that seem to be strongly controlled by structural dip. That is, water moving down structural dip in this particular case to the axis of a syncline, or in this example, water moving away from an anticline. That is, this anticlinal axis corresponding to a spring shed boundary. So in some places, we're seeing some good control. In others, for instance, this region, we don't see much apparent control. The water's moving up structural dip. What I'm going to go to next is an example in cross-section of the fountain spring shed right here. The die was entered in sinkholes, all right? The only thing we really know with a die trace is where it goes in and where it comes out. So clearly this is conjectural, but it's drawn this way for a couple of reasons. We do know static water levels, or the water table, is down to this level, so we have a thick, unsaturated section. We have quarry exposures of these rocks that do show prominent vertical joints and vertical joints with solution cavities near the Prosser-Cummingsville contact. So this isn't entirely fiction. Some of this is based on reality. And we also know that the die travels at very high speeds. We're talking kilometers per day, speeds of kilometers per day. So that kind of, that's the kind of information that kind of goes into this cross-section to lead us to believe that a setting consistent with all those observations would be one in which the die is entered into a sinkhole, rapidly travels down one of these vertical joints, reaches a well-connected conduit system in the lower part of the Cummingsville, travels structurally down dip, and emerges at the Big Springs area near Fountain. The next one I'm going to go to is the Starless Spring Shed, where the flow travels up structural dip. And with Starless, it's a very different setting. You can see that right away for a number of reasons. The die is entered up here in losing streams. We're dealing here with a very thick stratigraphic package. The cross-section I showed you earlier gets cut off right about here in the fountain area. Here we're adding a number of other units, including some aquitards. The saturated interval of rock is much higher. That is, the water table nearly approximates the land surface in the western edge here. And our hypothesis, or our guess, as to the way the die goes from the entry point to the exit point is in the stair-stepping fashion, particularly through large vertical joints near incised valleys, which again we often see in large quarry exposures in this part of the county. The position of many of these preferentially developed bedding parallel conduits is also based on outcrop observations and actual mapping of caves, many of which prefer, in this particular instance, preferably occur along the Stewartville-Dubuque contact. And what I'd like to finish with is a comparison of the two and just a somewhat arm wavy, but a discussion of what might be the reason that in some settings you have strong structural control and in others you don't by contrasting these two different areas. Let's return to Fountain here first. It's a largely drained karstic interfluve setting. All right. If you remember the map view, it was kind of a peninsula of the Galena group, all right, and largely drained, thin saturated section, no internal aquitards that we're aware of, and thus the system is simply a free surface flow system which must flow downhill, all right? It's just a gravity flow system. It's as simple as that. Well, here things are much more complex. We've got this thicker saturated section. We know we have internal aquitards. We're adjacent to a regional potentiometric high. If we were to extend this cross-section even tens of miles west, we'd be increasing in head as we move in that direction. And with this fully saturated system, what we believe is we have filled, once the dye reaches this level, we have filled conduit flow driven eastward by high heads to the west. And the last piece of information I'll give you on that kind of explains it in a different way, is there's a beautiful set of data from the Amoco Spring Valley Terminal with West Bay ports in multi-ported wells that indicate, for instance, in the Cummingsville, the head in the Cummingsville alone is at an elevation of about 1,290 feet. So even in this part of the saturated section, the head is much higher than the level of the spring at which the dye emerges. And I'm trying to give you an example of how this flow through head is driven eastward up stratigraphic dip or up structural dip. And to finish up then, what we think is that structure may be a useful predictor of flow directions in specific settings, albeit even in those areas inconsistently. And the specific settings I'm talking about, for instance, are these karstic interfluve areas that are largely drained, and therefore, in this kind of setting, showing a strong influence of structure on flow directions and not working so well in areas with internal aquitards and a more complex potentiometric type of setting. And I'm out of time, huh? That was a good one to end with. Thank you.
Thank you very much.